Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, we feature two experts from our U.S. election panel, Denise Chisholm, sector strategist, and Jim Fibio, Fidelity's political expert. Denise, Jim, and host Pamela Ritchie discuss the upcoming U.S. election, where polling currently stands, and the impact potential outcomes could have on the market. Jim dives into the intricacies of how U.S. politics work and the different posts that could be assigned under a Biden government, while Denise examines what stimulus can be expected and the different catalysts surrounding the election that could affect market movements. Today's podcast was recorded on October 27th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Given the extraordinary circumstances in which the democratic process is unfolding with mail-in ballots en masse this time around, investors are preparing for a variety of scenarios, including the potential for a drawn-out contestation. So, how to view the markets in this week and perhaps afterwards? Help lead us through this conversation today, we are joined by our countdown panel. Sector strategist and market historian Denise Chisholm joins us, and Fidelity's political expert and head of government relations, Jim Fibio, also here with us today. Denise, Jim, welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us.
Great to see you, Pamela.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well. Glad to have you here with us. Jim, I'll begin with you, if you don't mind. Can we take a look at something granular, perhaps, but really just going into the various states that we really need to keep an eye on, that need to be watched? Take us through that, what perhaps investors should know and where to watch.
Sure. And I think that's a really good point, because as we all know, in 2016, President Trump won by the narrowest of margins, turning places like Wisconsin and Michigan red and Pennsylvania. And so I think we need to focus on those same states. I think we need to keep a keen focus on Florida and Ohio again. And I think we're starting to see, I don't know if it's gamesmanship or real at this point, but we see former Vice President Biden campaigning in Georgia and talk of a pretty tight race at the presidential level, even in Texas. Now, I don't think Texas is necessarily ready to flip, but I know there's been a long effort to turn Texas, which is maybe a lighter shade of red these days, to turn that state blue. But I think on election night, folks are wondering whether we'll know the outcome. If President Trump does not win Florida and Ohio, it's probably going to be an early night, and we'll know. If we have to wait on recounts in a place like Pennsylvania, as deciding with its 20 electoral votes, we might be in for a little bit of a delay, but I have confidence in the process that at some period shortly after the election, if not on election night, we will have an answer. So I know we're all looking forward to some certainty. I think to your earlier point, just record numbers of turnout so far, 66 million votes cast early. That has surpassed the 2006 levels of all early voting all the way up to election day. And we still have a week to go. And I think there is there's been a lot of reporting about more ballots being requested and sent in by registered Democrats. I would caution that that doesn't mean they necessarily voted Democrat, but that just means that's where the registration is. And I do think there's been an element of President Trump stoking some doubt into the validity of mail-in ballots. And a lot of the Trump supporters, I think, are waiting to vote either in person early or in person on election day. But just with the number of votes cast already, that's going to be a pretty significant delta to potentially close. The other quick thing I'd point out in the states is a lot of folks are comparing back Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania to 2016 and saying, well, President Trump's doing better than he did again, polling-wise on an average basis than he did against Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. I think the major difference this time is the number of undecided voters has shrunk considerably. So there's a lot less room to make up that gap. But there is still the flip side of that. There still is a lot of discussion about non-response bias and Trump supporters not being willing necessarily to tell pollsters that they plan to vote for the president. So we're all going to be
What
waiting
do
and
you
watching
think of
along
that?
with you.
What do you think of that, Jim? That idea, it's sort of sort of they call it the quiet Trump vote or whatever. Like, what do you think of that concept? Is that blown out of proportion, or is that what do you think?
There had been some research on that, and I think there is something to it. I mean, on the one hand, you've got Trump supporters who are willing to fly flags on their boats and do car parades and shout out loud, and then there are others who are in other communities where, I think there is some fear of affiliation of saying they're for Trump, and you know, I think that could be around the mood in the country, how neighbors feel about things, and so you know, they're not willing to put the yard sign out because they don't want to get in a fight with the so there might be some element of that. I just don't know the magnitude.
Yeah, interesting. It's a number of issues that we need to watch for. And it's really interesting to sort of have the subtleties within the states. Denise, parallels to 2016, really, I guess, on the sort of market side of things. As I recall, you know, it looked like Hillary Clinton was going to win, but then there was a release of emails through Comey, and we sort of know that story. Things seem to change. From a market perspective, are there parallels to draw at all?
Yeah, it's tough when you go back to draw parallels just because everything feels so different. And I think I get that a lot from investors. What that doesn't mean is that history can't help you, because I think many things feel different, but what investors always need to stay focused on is that the market's a discounting mechanism. So we saw that even in 2018, sort of 17, 18 with tariffs, right? It was very, very different. It felt very different. It was the first time tariffs were going to increase potentially substantially in over 25 years. And yet the market was able to discount that in advance. And we certainly saw the difference in terms of the recession that we potentially just went through and are emerging from. That was very different. And yet again, we see this sort of the market as a discounting mechanism. So I do want to caution investors to think about that as they relate it to the headwinds that you may see or that may come with the election. And one of the key things that I'm focused on is this high uncertainty level. And that is what makes it feel so different this time. But you can actually study uncertainty, and there's a couple of good data series on it. And what you'll see is whatever data series that you're looking at, these are very uncertain times, and you can quantitatively measure that. What's interesting from a market perspective is that those high levels of uncertainty have the highest quartile of the odds of a market advancement and the highest average returns. So that gets back to this point of the market as a discounting mechanism. But there's a catch, Pamela. There's definitely a catch. In that top quartile of uncertainty, there's 60% more volatility. So you have to put up with the volatility or the bumpy ride from an investment perspective to achieve those higher returns.
And now we've got, I mean, just to add to the uncertainty around everything, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. I mean, okay, so you kind of told us those pieces. Can you, from your perspective, see what is priced in? I mean, there are those that will say maybe a Biden win is more priced in. I mean, what is priced in? Do you know? Can you see that?
The way I think about priced in is sometimes people talk about it through valuation, but valuation isn't really that predictive, especially when you have a massive fall off in earnings. The way I measure it is one, I just talked about through uncertainty, but two, there are certain dislocations in the market that you can actually measure. One is valuation spreads, and the other is, let's call it, the relative valuation of beta or risk. So let's talk about the first one really quick. Valuation spreads are a big difference between stocks in terms of how the market is valuing them on what stocks that investors feel are safe, because they sell everything. Investors, when they're panicked, sell everything they think is risky, buy everything they think is safe, bid up the valuations. So those names change every recession, but that gap actually remains. That gap is still wide, and that gap is normally predictive of higher than average market returns. You also see the same phenomenon in terms of the relative valuation of, let's call it, cyclicality or more economically sensitive sectors relative to either the S&P or those defensive sectors. You still see those gaps. That to me means that the market is still concerned about something, some kind of headwind, whether it be election uncertainty, whether it be higher taxes, whether it be sort of just uncertainty around when we know who the president is, which gives you that clue as an investor that many, many more things than you think may actually be discounted.
So interesting. Jim, does anyone in Washington, D.C. these days think that stimulus is coming in the next 7 days? Is there any hope left for that at this stage?
I think hope is pretty dim at this point. I think both sides have dug in a bit. And while I think the White House and the House Democrats may have reached a deal pre-election, I still get the sense Senate Republicans are not willing to go along with excessive spending at this point, or some of where the money's directed and where the House proposal would be, particularly in terms of support for states that are ailing from their COVID response efforts. So I think there's definitely a lame duck period coming up, and there's everyone always wants to know, can it get done after the election? And I think part of it depends on the outcome of the election. Sometimes members of Congress and the incoming crew might want to wait and do it their way. Other times they might want to get what they can now in the short term and come back for more stimulus. The start of a new administration if Biden does take office.
So it's interesting, Denise. I might sort of bring this back to you. The discussion of, you know, within the markets, the vaccine does seem to be sort of at least one of the big catalysts that we're waiting for when we can reach that. And therefore the question of what stimulus is needed in the meantime. Can you help us read, you know, how those factors within there are playing into the markets, but perhaps also the response on the fiscal stimulus front?
Sure. I think part of the stimulus question is duration of an abnormal economy. So we always need to think about the fact that this would be, I think, the fourth, Jim can correct me if I'm wrong, but the fourth stimulus package. We've already had three, and those three have provided something we've never seen in recessions, which is aggregate income, if you include transfer payments, actually rose, as did the savings rate, as did C&I lending or any kind of lending that you would look at. This is very rare in terms of recessionary events. So we provided a bridge to that weak unemployment number. So it is a question of how long of a bridge do we need, which is some sort of ending point, and we can argue about how much of an end point it would be a vaccine. But I think it's important to understand that we have provided a stimulus already, and two, that bridge might not be as necessary to the market as many investors think.
That is fascinating. Jim, tell us a little bit more on that front. Is there anything to add to the stimulus that we need to know sort of in various permutations that the election could result in? There's sort of this discussion of a blue wave, a light blue wave, or in fact, don't see a blue win on either side. I mean, how does stimulus fit with the scenarios?
Excellent question. And I think a lot of it hinges on not just the White House, but also the direction of the Senate. And if the Democrats take over the Senate, I think there is, and it's a full blue wave, I think there's far greater likelihood of more significant stimulus, support for states and localities, perhaps even infrastructure spending and so forth. I think the Republicans, if they still have control of the Senate, there might still be some fiscal conservatism that creeps in, and not willing to extend unemployment benefits to an extent that on their side they would view is disincentivizing work. If you could make more money staying home, not incentivizing states to be reckless with their budgets and other areas even beyond COVID. So again, less support on the state side. So I'd be watching the Senate, quite honestly, in terms of the next phase of stimulus.
Denise, can I ask you on the unemployment picture? I mean, we watch the numbers come in monthly. Obviously, we've seen that they have come back. How important is the employment picture to really where the market goes, even if we take the election out, I suppose? Can we take the election and look at employment?
Yeah, when you think about the market as it relates to unemployment, I'll give you a couple of interesting facts about it. One, it sort of highlights that the market is a discounting mechanism. Anytime the unemployment rate is actually in the top quartile of its history, regardless of what it does, if you're willing to extend your time horizon out a year, the market has about 80% odds of advancement, which is pretty high and higher than its sort of baseline going back to 1950. The more interesting thing that we've seen is the survey data. So initial claims have remained high the entire time, and even though they've come down, are much, much higher than any prior recession. The problem is in terms of the comparison. So it's very, very different this time, and we're not quite sure what we're measuring. But the interesting measurement that's been consistent through history is actually surveys, either of businesses or consumers. If you want to know about the labor market, just ask the people that are in it. And that actually suggests, it's part of the Conference Board survey, the jobs hard to get quotient, that actually suggests that the unemployment rate as observed by people in the market is much, much lower. So I think that, you know, maybe that captures some of the fact that they have income, providing that bridge so you're not experiencing the detrimental effects of that higher unemployment rate. But if you popped it in a linear regression, it would actually suggest that the unemployment rate as observed by individuals is about 5.5%. So again, I think that, the direction is more important than the level in terms of the change to the market. So unemployment rate continuing to come down is really what the market needs to see to continue its advance.
There's a question here, Jim, coming in. So how are early voter ballots counted? Is it all done on November 3rd? Can you just go to the process a little bit of how everything comes in? And, you know, are there pitfalls or maybe helpful sides to the mail-in ballot? I don't know which are more appropriate.
Right. I think in some places they can start counting early, and other places they have some flexibility to continue counting after Election Day for ballots that are at least postmarked by Election Day. You've seen some court challenges to shut down some of the counting beyond Election Day in some places. So it really is, it's going to vary state by state. I look at a place with like Pennsylvania and the 20 electoral votes there, and I think about how many votes have been cast, how long will it take to count them, and how long it took to count primary votes in New York, where we had to wait weeks to hear of the outcome. And so I am not sure yet. I'm gonna keep my fingers crossed. It's not too long, prolonged a process, but based on past experience, it looks like, you know, we might have to wait a little bit. I would remind folks, have some faith in the system. Bush versus Gore was decided by the Supreme Court in early December. So we've gone a good 5 to 6 weeks without knowing a winner. I have confidence that we'll be fine, and we'll figure our way through it. And there is a backup plan in place if there is a controversy.
So let's just talk about the backup plan. Actually, if we can just be brought up the Supreme Court, what is the role of the Supreme Court in an election?
So as the Supreme Court would not step in and pick a winner or loser in a close race. I believe there would have to be a case or controversy of voter fraud or voting irregularities that would be brought to the Supreme Court. Now, their ultimate decision could have the impact of determining who wins. So that is important, but they wouldn't be picking between the candidates. That they're the third branch of government. There's a separate process for that. In the event of a tie of electoral votes, it goes to the House of Representatives. The House would vote by delegation. So not by the raw numbers of who's in the majority, but the number of delegations. The Republicans enjoy a slight majority, but after this election, that could shift in terms of the number of state delegations they control. If it's still a tie, there's a process by which the Speaker of the House, it would be whoever the Speaker is elected at the start of the next Congress prior to Inauguration Day. So we're going far afields now, but just so folks know that there are backup plans. I'm sure it would there'd be a lot of debate and contest around it, but there are processes that can be turned to.
Oh, that's great. It's good. It's good to get sort of a picture of that. Denise, so many questions rolling in here. This one for you. What are your thoughts on the tech sector? How do we see more regulation coming down the pipeline? Is tech evergreen, as you have, I think, spoken about it in the past in different contexts? Do investors need to be worried about tech at all?
Yeah, let's talk about tech relative to like a value rally, and then I'll talk about tech individually because I think that they're different. There is certainly this investor fear or concern that tech, given its nature, given that its dominance in terms of outperformance, we're sort of due for a value rotation into financials and energy. And while I understand that investors are afraid of that, given what we just saw in 2009 and a little bit in the call it a recession of 2000, where everything that you saw, or 90% of sector leadership, really changed hands into and out of that recessionary stock market trough. So you had to sell everything that you owned going into that trough and buy everything that you didn't in order to outperform. So this recession feels different from those who've been through those two cycles. But when you actually study history, most recessions are not like that. They do, Pamela, to your point, have this evergreen sector. In fact, 1 to 3 sectors actually outperformed the 6 months before a recession, the 6 months going into that stock market recessionary trough, and the 6 to 12 months coming out. And our technology leadership isn't really that different from leadership that we saw out of the 1982 low from consumer discretionary. So there are parallels in this evergreen leadership. Look at the relative performance, the 12 months before a recession and the 12 months after. I have to say that I really don't see anything anomalous in technology leadership. So let's talk about that specifically. And I think one of the reasons why I don't see anything anomalous is because what technology is doing on an earnings basis and on a free cash flow basis has been very rare for a cyclical sector to be able to do, meaning that they grew earnings faster and free cash flow faster than the market into a downturn. So they were protective. And because fundamentals were so strong and valuation starting point wasn't particularly expensive, we are now back down to the bottom quartile of its relative valuation on earnings or free cash flow in the data set that I have back to 1962. So this is a very rare setup where you're already back down to some supportive valuation levels for a very, very big sector in the S&P. None of the other sectors look like that when I look back in terms of valuation and fundamentals. And I think that that puts tech solidly in this optionality of a positive risk reward to continue to be that evergreen sector despite headwinds.
So fascinating. Lots of questions rolling in for both of you right now. Jim, I'll put this to you. Tell us a little bit about the period in between. So there is a win that ultimately is settled upon. Who might we see, because we don't know who Biden necessarily would put in should he win. Are there names being discussed? Are there certain areas that we should look to Treasury for hints about how an administration might move in certain directions? What other important posts are there for us to watch?
That's an excellent question in terms of it gets right to the heart of how would a Biden administration and how would a President Biden govern. And he's got to think about the left flank and the progressive wing, and then maybe where he would traditionally have been more in the middle. And so I would expect to see a range of ideologies appointed to key posts. I think we'd probably see more of progressives falling into places like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, like the Environmental Protection Agency, Health and Human Services. By the time you get down to financial regulation in our world, we haven't really had strong ideologues chairing the SEC. If you think back, the last three SEC chairs were registered independents. Now, they leaned right or left, depending on the administration appointing them. But Mary Shapiro, Mary Jo White, and currently Jay Clayton were all registered independents. And some of the names I think we've heard for Treasury, which is an important post, because whoever chairs the Treasury also chairs the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which has a significant voice in the future of regulation of financial markets. We've heard names of former and current Federal Reserve Board officials, Leo Brannard, Sarah Bloom Raskin. We've heard of, Larry Fink's name was out there. I believe he told his board that he wasn't interested in it. So at this point, there's a lot of speculation. I would expect to see a lot of members of the Obama administration that had experience in these posts potentially be reconsidered and maybe come back in different places. Those who have speculated about Elizabeth Warren as a potential Treasury Secretary, I think, or any post in a Biden cabinet, depending how close the Senate is, I would remind folks there's a Republican governor in Massachusetts who would appoint Elizabeth Warren's replacement if she was pulled out of the Senate. And so a special election wouldn't take place for, I think it's 160 or 180 days is the limit on. So there potentially could be an impact on the balance of power in the Senate that would impact not just Senator Warren, but other Democrats that we might expect to come out of the Senate and into a Biden administration, might depending on who's running the state.
That is fascinating. You know, just how there might be posts open, but they may not be people who can actually jump into them necessarily, depending on the election. Denise, I'm going to close with this question. Great question coming in. Summarize for us. Do elections matter? You've spoken about the employment picture, a little bit about earnings, all these things that keep the markets rolling and moving, the vaccine story. So does the election, is it going to move the markets, I guess, is the question.
For a longer term horizon, I think that the data I look at is that that's not likely. So, and you can see this in terms of what we've talked about, the market is a discounting mechanism. It receives some stimulus to offset it, or there's another overarching driver that may be the earnings recovery that we see coming out of the pandemic. So I think I'd keep those three things in mind. And when you look at election math, as much as I think investors sort of want to say one side works better than the other for the markets, what you really notice when you study history is that the odds and the average returns really start to depend on what time frames you include and whether or not four-year returns. And what I think that tells you as an investor is that it's inconsistent through history. So when something's inconsistent through history, again, you have to focus on the market may discount it in advance, it may receive stimulus to offset it, or there might be another more dominant theme that's the bigger driver.
Fascinating. Jim, what is the most fascinating thing to you so far from your very educated position of observing what's unfolding? Is there something that, you know, is kind of a clanger, you know, just something, it's kind of fascinating to you?
So one thing I can't do the math on is the president's approval rating has just hung at 43% coming in, you know, and you, when we pre-crisis, you went to the lowest levels unemployment on record, you would have expected any president to shoot up with you, some of the issues around some of the racial injustice and social unrest and the president's treatment of of COVID and other things, you would have thought it would have plummeted. It hasn't. It's just stayed. And so he got elected when he was in a similar range of support. I have a really hard time to hear question doing the math on that in particular. The other thing that I've been surprised by is just former Vice President Biden's just very consistent lead in the polls, and the national polls don't matter as much, but as we started this conversation, even if looking at those key swing states, he's maintained that lead despite what we might have figured would have been the normal ups and downs of a campaign. So I'm curious to watch how much tightening potentially happens down the stretch. And I think this comes back to where we started. The most impressive thing is the turnout. And I would encourage anyone on the US side that's watching to go out and vote. I'm expecting we'll see record turnout by the end of election day, which is a great thing.
Yeah, the turnout story, obviously something that we're going to watch very closely. Denise Chisholm, Jim Fibbio, thank you very, very much for your deeply insightful comments today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Have a great day. Thanks very much for joining us today. I'm Pamela Ritchie.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. So, do you find yourself wondering how rising debt levels are affecting today's investment decisions? Well, Fidelity Portfolio Managers David Wolf and David Talk's latest asset allocation paper, Debt is Fine Until It Isn't, is now available. The paper walks you through how David Wolf and David Talk are adjusting their active asset allocation strategies to address the consequences of today's debt-driven markets. You can read the paper at fidelity.ca under the Expert Insights section. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.